Somebody, a couple, will be ready to stand down. You guys know this.
When he might have given her a tender my way, when sorrows like his own blood for my soul.
Chapter 31, 2, and we'll just wait until somebody opens us in prayer.
Heavenly Father, we want to thank you so much for another day of life you've given to us. We come to you in the name of Jesus Christ to beg you, Lord, to teach us as we are here, to open our heart to understanding and comprehension, to learn how to walk holy as you called us to be holy. Let us not be deceived by the wicked one. Help us, Lord. Help us remove the sinful nature in us. Cleanse us. Give us a new heart of flesh that will honor you and respect you, fear you. All those things that we take for granted, Lord. We are here to ask of you on our knees, Lord. Have mercy and grace. Have mercy and grace, Lord. You have given us understanding to go to come this far, Lord. Please, Lord, don't let us go. Hold on. Help us to hold on to us. Be patient with us, Lord. Teach us how to be like your Son, Jesus Christ, which is the only way that you could see us, is through your Son, your darling Son, who went on a cross for us. Lord, we beg of you, break our hearts. Break our hearts to every single one that is in this room and to many who wish to be here, that you may look upon them, Lord, with favor in your heart, that they may bring gladness to you by your works, not ours. Open our eyes, Lord. Remove the blindness. Give us ears to hear you and heart to understand you. Remove our pride, Lord. And as we are here, we beg, Lord, that you may teach our leader to bless him, Lord. Put your words in his mouth that he may speak your words into our hearts. We thank you for this place you've given us. And we ask of you to bless those around us, in our families, in our friends, relatives, many that we wish that will understand you and we want to talk to them. But instead, they give us the back. Instead, they reject you. But Lord, we ask of you, have mercy on them too, Lord.
Have mercy.
For you had mercy on us.
Yes.
You are the one that decides when and how, Lord.
Yes.
So we stand here, we sit here, we beg here. Please, Lord, touch us.
Touch us,
Lord. In Jesus Christ, I pray for all the men to continue to be, and if not, to start being the leaders at home,
yes,
as you call us to be, men of God.
Yes.
In Jesus Christ, I pray. Amen.
Heavenly Father, Dios, Father, Dios, just want to ask you and thank you for our pastor. Thank you for this family, Lord, in this room.
Thank you, Lord. Yes.
Thank you for my sisters and my brothers, Lord.
Yes.
Thank you for all the blessings, Lord. And we would like you to ask you to open our hearts, Lord, our minds to listen by your word, Lord, and to know about what marriage is all about, Lord.
Yes.
It's about you, Lord.
Right.
I want to thank you, Lord, in Jesus' name we prayed. Amen.
Amen. So I want to ask you guys, did you get a chance to do exercise number one? How many of you did exercise number one? Only a handful of y'all did. Did y'all quit right in the middle of this? Y'all done? Are we through? No more exercises, Pastor? So we were supposed to do exercise two a couple weeks ago. How many of you guys did exercise two? So we got a little better. But y'all, nobody did exercise. How many of y'all did exercise one? So half of y'all did exercise one. Oh, okay. All right. So we had some wonderful discussion around exercise one. By the way, that The material that you have in front of you, some of you that are new, it says Thursday schedule. We're kind of working through that as we hone in position one and two. But the piece of paper that I want in front of you is called the Operational Goals of Marriage. That's what we're going to kind of focus in on tonight, since we've already laid a foundation in our discussion. There's paper on the back table and pens and pencils. For those of you who did do exercise one, what came to your mind? In exercise one, the project is to build your own ideal man or woman. So what I want to, first of all, before we get into our text and start working on positions one and two in relationship to Proverbs 31, what came to your mind when you saw that exercise? I want some honest people tonight. I don't want any religious folk, just honest people tonight. What came to your mind just the moment you thought about building my own man or my own woman? What came to your mind, sister?
Some of the things that my husband don't do right now.
Uh-huh.
What I would like him to do.
Okay, so in your mind, building has to do with bringing assets to the table that you would like for him to engage in. Okay, that's good. That's good. That's good. It's an opportunity to articulate how you want your husband to be. That's a good thought. What did you have, Felix?
I immediately fell into my flesh and just started.
Immediately he fell into his flesh. He thought, if I have the chance to build her from scratch. Did some brothers, did anybody identify with that? Did you get caught up? Some sisters did? Zandra, did you deal with the whole exterior posterity? Okay. That's not a bad thing. I just want some honest people. If you had a chance to build your spouse, wouldn't that be off the hook? Who has some thoughts beyond that, Sister Kathy?
When I first looked at this, I thought, this can't be. I mean, it'll never happen.
It'll never happen. So for you, this was a complete figment of your imagination, totally isolated in the ethereal world of a matrix. There's no crossover into reality at all. Boy, you were in trouble, Michael. Oh, that was the first thought. Okay, so what was the second thought?
That I read where he said, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I said, okay.
Okay.
And real.
Okay.
And realistic.
Good, good.
So to be realistic, I had to kind of set the bar.
Mm-hmm. Lower it a little bit. Good. Lower it a little bit. Lower it for us brothers. I want to know. I just want to know what was the thought process for some of you who did it. I had a reason for writing it. I framed this material to get inside your head because when it comes to marriage, one of the things that we don't understand is that sometimes we have ideas already in our head, but they have to be brought up. Did we quote Proverbs chapter 20, verse 5 last week in our Thursday class? Did we quote that? That counsel in the heart of man is like what? Deep water. And a man of understanding is able to do what? Draw it out. And so if you send a person down the right direction. And in the Hebrew, one of the Hebrew words for teaching is the metaphor for shooting an arrow. One of the Hebrew words for teaching is shooting an arrow. And the goal and objective is to send a person down a path that if they follow that path, truth will open up to them. Now, that's different than you actually spoon feeding them truth. You're just sending them down a path where revelation opens up and they now begin to discover things. And that's what I wanted to do with exercise two. I actually wanted you to discover some things. So I want a couple more responses. What did you get out of that? Even those of you who looked at it and said, I have absolutely no idea what I'm doing. I'm way out of the map. Anyone here? Anybody else? Before Miss Alma.
I was looking at the different sections and I wasn't quite sure like if I wrote a sentence like I wanted him to be honest, I didn't know whether that was a quality or a gift.
Of course.
Or could I put them in that same word in all three sections?
Well, if honesty is a quality, and I believe it is, don't you?
Yeah.
To be honest is a quality. We call that a virtue. It's a virtue. It's a characteristic. But if I don't have it and then I obtain it, I can also call that a what? A gift. Right? So if I think that my husband or my spouse should be more honest or should acquire honesty, which means they aren't honest at all, and that, therefore this class is a great class, right? Then I need to be praying for, and I'm not implying that with Brother Mac at all. I want to pray that God would instill that quality in my spouse. Because I can tell you that at the top of the list of problems with couples is a lack of honesty. That's why position number one is so critical. Now, when you see couples diminish, when couples diminish in the quality of their relationship, when their relationship deteriorates, it's because honesty has now diminished. And you guys know that, right? Because we saw that we went from the concept to the conflict of Genesis 3, verses 1 through 7, where they ran, hid, started sowing what? That's dishonesty. Now we're operating out of a complete paradigm of dishonesty, aren't we? We have been taught by the wicked one that the world is about us. As a consequence, we became self-conscious. Remember that? That prior to their fall, they were naked and not what? Ashamed. And as a consequence, they were not stuck on self. Self is self-conscious when no other reality prevails in our heart and mind. So we're governed by how we look. We're governed by how we feel. We're governed by what other people think about us. As well, our spouse. And if our spouse, remember what we learned in position number one last week, if our spouse or spouse-to-be appears to disapprove of who I am in reality, and I'm saying who I am in reality, then I'm going to be inclined to do one or both of the things that are seen in the pathological behavior of our first parents. I'm going to hide behind the trees. And then I'm going to cover myself up with fig leaves and perpetrate a fraud because I'm not free to be me because of shame. Right? So that's a real problem if we are not operating out of what? A cross-centered, Bible-based, Spirit-anointed relationship where shame is dealt with by Calvary. And so the lesson to build your ideal man or woman is designed to serve two roles, to allow you to think through and articulate how you really want your spouse to be, as well as to hear yourself audibilize how you think about your spouse. You guys got that? Two things. Because sometimes we have these deep thoughts about each other that do not get brought to the surface in a way that we can articulate them. So we're living with split screens. Some of you have heard me use that metaphor before on television. I'm watching two games at once. And sometimes I'm paying attention to one game more than the other, but that other game is the relationship between me and her. In my mind, I'm thinking one thing. In my words, I'm saying something else. I'm warm. You guys warm yet? Okay. Just let me know when you start freezing. So the exercise was designed to help you do a number of things. One is to see how thorough you have been thinking through the virtues you would like for your spouse to possess. In counsel, I want to hear from somebody else as well. So raise your hand if you're ready to share with what was in your thoughts on this. In counsel, okay. In counsel, when I'm dealing with people, and I've said this audibly before, but in counsel, when I'm dealing with people, one of the things I get in relationship, in conflicts, is the complaining category. Remember, we were talking about once the four horsemen start setting in really well, criticism becomes a prominent thought process. Is that true? We start thinking critically of our spouse. And critical thinking will put us in that category of complaining. both to them and about them. Generally, by the time people come to counsel, it's because we have done so much complaining that we have hit a crossroads, and we need some help unraveling the complexity of the offense, complaining. What I say about complaining is this. When you hear yourself complain, and we complain, when you hear yourself complain, say this. I'm complaining because I don't have the answer. When I hear myself complaining, I'm complaining because I don't have the answer. Because if I had the answer, I would no longer complain about it. And this is true for the whole of the Christian life, whether it's in the context of marriage or in anything. So when you meet people who complain a lot about a lot of things, they are extroverts who have sort of a half-baked process of thinking. They think in terms of what they see, but they don't think in terms of how to resolve things. They don't see the blessing of a problem being a challenge to solve. They don't see the blessing of a problem being nothing but a challenge to solve. So when I'm dealing with couples and I'm listening to them and I pay careful attention to their words, and when I hear visceral words, when I hear pejorative words, when I hear hostile words, derogatory words, when I hear phrases that essentially are going to clamp the relationship down, they borderline on contempt. So we can do it in sort of double entendres, subtle speech patterns, phrases that essentially, you know, condemn our spouse. When I hear that, I say, you know, you're using the wrong kind of terminology. That terminology is exit terminology. We have talked about this before. I said that language can do two things. It can be either a what? Door in, or it can be a door shut. It can shut out a person. It can be an obstacle. Your language can be an obstacle. Profound, because if you think through what we're talking about, we are talking about the whole person, spirit, soul, and body, right? Spirit, soul, and body. Spirit, soul, and body. So now, because we're an integrated being, threefold being, trifold being, spirit, soul, and body, and I'll just say this while I'm warming us up, don't make the mistake of separating that trifold nature of your being, that somehow your spirit is separated from your soul and your soul is separated from your body. Just like the mystery of the Trinity, so is the mystery of humanity, and particularly the mystery of those who know Christ. Christ in you, the hope of glory, is a mystery. And when Paul talks about this mystery in terms of his inability to handle it, he said in Romans chapter 7, the good that I would, I do not, the evil that I would not do, that I find myself doing. You guys know that text, right? He's talking about a mystery of the conflation of the spirit, the soul, and the body. That while there is a distinction between the spirit and a distinction between the soul and a distinction between the body, they are still integrated, fused together in such a way that they are interdependent. Yes, they are. Which means that when I talk to my spouse about theological things aimed at his spirit or her spirit, if I say it in a way that is offensive to her soul, she is not going to receive it well because the soul and the spirit are integrated. You need Jesus. Is that going to come home pretty? It may be a totally theologically sound proposition, but it's going to shoot right past the spirit. And it's going to pierce the soul. And as the proverb says, a brother offended is harder than the bars of a castle. So knowing how to use language, both in terms of the propositional content as well as the emotional content. Remember what I said? We also have this problem that we got to work through. We got to learn how to become more emotionally what? Intelligent. Emotional intelligence. And it's important for us to be able to determine where we are on that spectrum. Are we aware, emotionally aware? That's one. Are we emotionally sensitive? That's two. Are we emotionally insensitive? That's three. Are we emotionally intelligent in the sense that we can actually solve the problem? Do we have solving skills? That's four. Do we have solving skills? And there are a number of other things that I can bring to the table. Am I emotionally discerning? Am I emotionally competent? Those are all good questions. Am I emotionally aware, emotionally sensitive, emotionally discerning, emotionally competent? Do I have skill sets to be able to integrate theological concepts into my dialogue and relationship with my spouse on a level that affects them not only intellectually but emotionally as well? Aren't those good questions to have? Because remember what we learned? That there is a humanness to us all that cannot be neglected in the process of relationship. That we cannot relegate each other to mere propositional entities. But all propositions have to have their termination. They have to terminate in the human experience and the human response. So, i.e., those of you who are here, most of you are old enough to have had children, and you know you've made the mistake of not being emotionally intelligent with your children. Like you holler at your children all the time, or holler at them too much, or get on them in ways where you disregard the uniqueness of their human makeup, and because of that, you grate against them in a way that essentially sets them up for failure because you neglected their human element, their God-given character traits, inclusive of their sin nature, that may or may not go away until they die, which I have to regard. If I'm going to be emotionally intelligent in relationship to my six daughters and two sons, I have to regard the uniqueness of their temperament, their weaknesses and their strengths, their characteristics. I can't just be an authoritative dictatorial voice in their life. I'm destroying the relationship of their humanness. They'll shrink on me. They'll hide from me until they're old enough to run from me and fight against me. Right? Remember what we learned? We're all in what? How many modes? Three modes. What mode? Rest mode. No. Three modes we operate in. Rest, fight, or flight. Write that down if you're new here. You got to be able to just, this is part of emotional intelligence here. This is part of emotional intelligence. Here you are. Your sin nature is operating and you don't even recognize that you're in a mischievous mode. You guys don't do that. But I had a couple who had a revelation. Some of our couples have had revelations since they've been coming to the couples class. So they will come after me after class and say, Pastor, I got some profound insights into myself in this class, and I need some help because I've been messing it up with my teenage daughter. No wonder she's acting like she's acting. I need some help because she's off the hook. And when we unpacked that thing, the relationship was, it was toxic at the least and borderline abusive. But this is true with the husband and wife relationship when we're dysfunctional and unintelligent about the components that make up our personality. Am I telling the truth? And we have to be able to regard these things. And here's a word that I want to come into your head. You'll hear it on Sunday a little bit. If we're going to have a good relationship with our spouse, you have to be resolved to go to work. If you're not willing to work at this, forget it. It's going to fail. Forget it. It's going to fail. How many of us have been on the way out the door? I don't need anybody else's witness but mine. But it was a consequence of emotional unintelligence, stupidity, lack of skill sets, complaining and saying, you know, this thing is just unsolvable. I talked to us about this a couple of weeks ago. Irreconcilable differences. It wasn't irreconcilable differences. It was stupidity on my part because I thought that somehow I had all the answers when what I had to do was pursue them. So I had to turn the obstacle and the problem into a challenge. Then I had to stop being lazy and presumptuous and start doing my research and finding out what it means to relate to a person according to knowledge. And that process took several years to even get grasp a framework or an epistemology, just a basic system and grid of interpretation. And it put me in a place of humility because I had to do more listening than I did talking. For a number of years, I had to do more listening than I did talking. So this will help you. If you really want to be good at discerning and being appropriately sensitive to, more than aware, because you can be emotionally aware of somebody's predisposition, offense, and not be sensitive to it. Do you know you can be aware of how they are feeling and not be sensitive to it? So just to be aware of it is not enough. Until I move into an empathetic, sympathetic predisposition with them, I won't move towards them to help them in any kind of way. Now I have to examine myself. What's going on with me that even though I'm aware that they are emotionally moved, I'm insensitive to it. My heart is hardened. That becomes a problem. So now I know that I actually have the problem, not them. I have the problem. Before I can even begin to communicate with them on their level, I have to solve this emotional insensitivity that's going on within me that wants them to turn themselves into a pretzel for my agenda without me finding out how God made them, what were some of the issues that are going on in their life, of which over the last 7 or 8, 10 years that we were together, my wife wore fig leaves or hid behind trees because she wasn't safe in my environment, right? And so I'm like, why are you wearing those fig leaves? Why are you hiding behind those trees? Well, I'll come out. So this is safe, right? It's only going to be safe once I learn who she is so I can understand her true motive. Remember, a man of understanding is able to what? Draw it out. Draw it out. There's one other important point with that. I want to make sure you guys get this. I thought about this too. In the context of deliberating between her needs, his needs, her needs, we're talking and we're trying to solve each other's problems, right, in work mode, you both got to cooperate with the process. You can't cheat. You don't get to tell your husband, solve it all by himself. It does not work that way. It's a cooperative, mutual, the word I said a couple of weeks ago was reciprocating process. You are obligated as spouses to reciprocate. Does that make some sense? You have to reciprocate. It can't be a one-sided thing. It's virtually impossible for relationships to be happy where one person is toying 90% of the load. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work. When you said, I do to God, you were saying, I'm going all the way. I'm going to pour my heart into this. I'm going to participate to the same degree that he is. And that's the only way you can make it work. And then we have to work on getting past the fear of those things. So, Jamari, what were you thinking when you got when you found yourself working on exercise one, building your wife, building a wife?
First, let me say that I didn't do this shit. I'm just giving my thoughts.
Okay, when did you read it?
Right,
oh, just now? Okay. Well, you can hold on to your thoughts until after you do it, and then we can come back next week. Because there's a few of you that didn't do it. So when you get a chance to do it, we can come back and talk about it. And I said, I'd love to hear what. Because, see, it's one thing to hear the concept and say, whoa, and then start writing down your thoughts, which is good. It's another thing to go through the process of filling it out because you discover some other things about yourself that you didn't know. Like you have a whole bunch of stuff you want them to be that does not fall in the category, as Kathy said, of reality. That's a recipe for destruction as well. If you're going to paint your spouse into an impossible scenario with regards to how you want them to be, you're going to destroy them. But before you do that, put the big H word on your own forehead. What's that word? Hypocrite. Hypocrite. Put it on your own forehead and jump before they do because you're going to destroy your marriage. Because here's how this goes. Remember what we learned? Position number one is to see them for who they are. Isn't that right? Position number one is to see them for who they are. And if I effectually see my wife for who she is and I'm looking in her face mentally, conceptually, cognitively, in my thought process on a day-to-day basis, I will see past my wife to who? Myself. Won't I? I will see past my spouse and I will see myself through my spouse. I will see my own selfish desires through her because this is the mystery of the union. We become mirrors to each other. And I will see how I am unjustly desiring her to be something that I'm not being. This is true. But now if I work through the process, I'll get past her, past me, to Christ. And I'll be able to go when God purges my eyes so I can see her the right way. Purges my heart so that I can value her the right way. We talked about, do you treasure them? Do you treasure the relationship? Do you treasure God in them? If I'm seeing correctly, if my wife has brought something to the table that's redemptive, I'm supposed to see God in her. Because, remember, God said my problem was that I was alone. And that when he gave me a spouse, her job was to do what? Help me, right? Help me. So here she is, this help, and we'll talk about that down the line when I go into the etymology of what it means to be a helper. Here she is, a help. She may very well be helping me in many areas of my life, for which if I am ungrateful and I detach myself from the reality of all that help she's bringing to the table because I'm myopic in my vision and complaining about these other things, I'm going to actually throw away the blessings of God, the tangible providential blessings of God in my life. And I'm going to see what it feels like to have to tow this thing all by myself. Right? And so that's the challenge of seeing them, seeing through them to myself, seeing through them past myself to Christ and becoming thankful for my spouse. That's a lot of work, isn't it? But it's not a lot of work once you are positioned to do it, once you are conscious of it, and once it's something that you want to do. You know, years ago when me and my wife, we're all common in certain ways. We're all distinct in a lot of ways, but we're all common in certain ways, ladies and gentlemen, because we are part of the same culture. And so there are dynamics running through the vein of our human makeup that is similar. That's why when I listen to people talk, I can identify with them and speak into their situation. Because there are very few counseling situations that I've had with couples of which that couple was so uniquely different that there weren't other couples that had the same problem. Very, very seldom. Very seldom. So one could speak into what was going on. It's so very important for us as couples to understand we got to work at this, reciprocate this process, until we actually are renewed in our mind. Now hear me now. Renewed in our mind about the whole concept of marriage. Now, some of you are going to be blessed by that. Because one of the things with us is that we have a whole lot of bad, negative, skewed, unbiblical thought processes out of which we operate. And that prison is not truth. It's a lie. And we're trying to impose that lie upon our family and our spouse. Nothing could be more drudgerous, oppressive, absurd than to have a prism that you operate out of that doesn't correspond with truth. See, truth liberates when the heart's right. Isn't that right? Truth liberates. Even if it's painful, it liberates at the end of the day. But not a lie. I can't impose a lie on my family and have them to go through this bizarre escapade of life that's rooted in my own vision. It doesn't even correspond with reality. Somebody's going to be trying to jump out of that caboose every opportunity you get, right? Isn't that right? So we have to actually be able to walk in the light. Anybody else want to contribute to what their experience was before we go into the text? My brother. Good. I got a couple. Good. Let's keep talking. You know, we only got 6 weeks to go.
Well, I was doing it. First of all, the flesh stuff goes through my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But then I started thinking about the attributes I might want to add that I thought I wanted, or the attributes that I don't want to subtract, or maybe some attributes that I was taking for granted
yes.
and forgot about.
Yes.
And then I got like overwhelmed and like shut down.
That's all right. You know why? Because I've already warned you that what I wanted him to do was process the exercise. He thought, he gathered a bunch of thoughts, He was able to decipher those thoughts, the difference between what was already there versus that which was not there. And he saw that. And then he backed away. That's good. Anybody else? You want to say something? You want to say something, Miss Jean? No?
Okay. I think mine is probably a little too simple.
Too simple? Let's see.
Huh?
Let's see. What were you thinking?
Just simple, man. Just as far as friendship,
mm-hmm.
Connection.
That's what you want.
Yeah.
That's what you want your spouse to be a friend. You want to be able to connect. Want her to feel you,
yeah.
Right? You want her to feel you. Yeah, that's good stuff, brother. That ain't simple. That's simple. Because it's simple. He's right. It's simple, but it's not easy. It's simple, but it's profound. Because that really is our problem. Remember I told us that the fall cast us into a mode of phobias? We're in a phobia mode. We have a lot of phobias. Fear of heights, fear of darkness, fear of falling, fear of what? Rejection. Right? And that the one thing I don't want my spouse to do is reject me. Because I'm vulnerable to her. I'm vulnerable to her. If she rejects me, then my whole life tailspins because she's half of who I am in the whole of my life. Once she rejects me, now I'm stuck with a two-legged stool. Am I telling the truth?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Somebody else want to talk? Shannon, how you doing?
Good.
Good.
I thought it was interesting how many of the qualities that I'm looking for or building that Dennis has.
Mm-hmm.
He had more than.
Oh, okay.
I'm
going to have to pull you to the side and talk to you about Dennis.
Because
I know Dennis. Anybody else? That's good. You got a few things he needs? Like
a lot.
Okay, that he needs. Oh, good.
I got a lot that I need, yeah.
On yourself?
No. Like I said before, he has most of these qualities.
Mm-hmm. What does he not have that you need for him to have?
I'm not gonna tell you.
You ain't got to tell me. But did you discover it?
Yeah. There's like two on a list of like 14.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Mm-hmm. I'll see you in 5 years. Somebody else. No, was there somebody wanted Mr. Charlie, brother Charlie?
Yeah.
Don't get in trouble, boy. I'm getting in trouble with my girl here right now. Go on. Keep it real. Keep it real.
I lost my thought. When I first seen it, I kind of jumped out there and I said, hold on, pump the brakes.
Uh-huh.
I felt I was like kind of being a little bit unreal. And I said, okay, if he read this, he's going to say, Charlie putting it on a little too thick. But after a while, I hesitated because I really... I had some of the qualities, but other ones I felt like since I didn't, made some mistakes that I really just went with the safe ones that
mm-hmm.
I knew was good and
mm-hmm.
it can build up. And
that's
I didn't
right.
want to go with the appearance,
mm-hmm.
but I wanted to go with other qualities
that's
that
right.
I knew I needed.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. See, you've been married a minute, haven't you?
Yeah.
You said, you know what they use that word safe. 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 I know what safe means. Don't get in trouble, brother. Don't get in trouble.
I actually ran away from it because she was in the kitchen and said, go and grab the stuff so we can do our homework and bring
Ooh.
It to the dining room. So while she was in the kitchen, I glanced at the question. I said, there's going to be a fight here. I don't want nothing to do with it. And I went to the living room
uh-huh.
and just kind of hoping that she would forget about it. But she came out of the kitchen and said, come on, let's go over here and do it. And when I started looking at it, I thought we were going to get in some kind of a fight. But as I started thinking and putting down the stuff, I started realizing that I kind of paused and I looked at her and I started really realizing that a lot of the qualities that I want, she actually has.
Okay.
And then I started realizing that some of the qualities that she has, I lack.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thankful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's very persistent in certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very patient with certain things where I'm not. And so I started recognizing other areas where I'm selfish at times. And lately I've been noticing that. And I try to catch myself and try to correct myself. But it kind of worked out really good.
Good. In other words, he played it safe, too. Did he play it safe, brother? Did he play it safe? Can I get another sister before we shut it down? Brother Piper.
really enjoy Leticia and our favor that we have with each other is a total balance when I understand that, you know, she has a lot of good qualities like that I see that I said, wow, she can take it all the way and she could just, you know, be able to be patient, and I'm calling myself patient.
Uh-huh.
But when I see her in a true illustration, living and sharing our lives together, she has developed some things that I don't think in this lifetime I might acquire.
You won't.
So I enjoy her, and so it stopped me.
Uh-huh.
From all, this is my second marriage.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate, you know, these
classic. Uh-huh. They're good, aren't they? Yes. And it's good stuff, brother?
Yes,
sir. Yeah. Some of y'all enjoying what's going on in this class?
Yeah.
Are you really enjoying this class? I hope so, because really what this is designed to do is raise your consciousness to the fact that marriage was never designed to be winged. You don't just wing it. You work it. You don't wing it. You work it. Sister Erica.
Wait.
Hold on now. We got to get you on tape.
I was going to say, with regard to the exercise, I think when I did it and when I was reading it, I was trying to build it, not so much an idea, but work with what I have with
mm-hmm,
him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the qualities, they were there.
Uh-huh.
Unless we would have never been together. They just got lost.
Got it.
You know what I mean? So it's bringing
them back. Did you get that? They were there, but somebody stored them in the garage or in the yeah. Bad quality relationship can do that. It can store virtues away because we're in fight mode so much. Am I telling the truth?
Mm-hmm.
You want to say something else?
No, that's just what I got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
are you going to pull some of that stuff out now? Are you going to pull some of that stuff out and put it on him? No, that's
put it on the wall.
Put it on the wall. You're going to put it in him. You're going to put it in him because hopefully by the time we're done, the point is that we have the privilege and responsibility to build each other up. We have the privilege and responsibility to build each other up. We just don't know how to do it. But we have the privilege and responsibility to do it. So this is what this is about. So I'm simply making you guys aware of these things, not to put you in a state of despair, but to prepare you to engage in putting these attributes and characteristics on each other so that you can enjoy each other to the maximum. You know what I liked about Piper's, Melvin's thoughts? He said it twice. I enjoy my wife.
Amen.
That's what you want to be able to do. Enjoy your spouse. I mean, just enjoy them. That's where we're going. The goal is to be able to enjoy each other, just to be able to be in each other's company and enjoy each other. And to do that, we got to learn to know each other. So let's go through the Proverbs a little bit. Proverbs 31, I'm going to be talking about the virtuous woman, and I'm going to make some observations. It's in your outline, Proverbs 31, 10 through 31. I'm not going to do a long exegesis on it, but I want to call your attention to a few things in here, and then we will work on some conflict issues as the Lord would open it up for us. In Proverbs 31, you know, you have that chapter where between the 80s and the year 2000, there were a lot of books sold on how to make women super women, super Christians. Some of you young people didn't go through that phase, but me and my wife went through that phase. And women can really go through periods of depression because of the weight of the marital status in the context of a culture that is anti-marriage. We live in an anti-marriage culture. It's just true. That was opened up to us at the fall of our first parents, but we live in an anti-marriage culture, which means in our culture, if the other person does not satisfy you, get rid of them and get somebody else. Some of you may have fallen into that trap too. But to do that is to simply admit your stupidity and lack of intelligence when it comes to the biblical concept of marriage and how to build your spouse up. People jump out because they don't have skill sets to build them up. They jump out. They jump out. They blame the other person for the problem, because I've never met a divorced person who said, you know what, Pastor Jesse, it was all my fault. Never met one. Never met one. But when I go through marital counseling and two people finally divorce each other, they're both guilty of not knowing and not doing, or knowing and not doing. And as a consequence, the marriage breaks because you can't wing it in the 21st century. You could wing marriage in the 16th century. You could wing marriage in the 1st century A.D. You could wing marriage 10,000 years B.C. Because culture was set up where marriage was a safeguard for the culture, for the family, for the village, for the tribe. Marriage was a safeguard. And in that safeguard, you had extra support that was assumed present. For instance, the fracturing of marriages today has been going on ever since in America and in Europe over the last 100, 150 years in America and Europe, prevalently because of philosophy and ideology that has crept into our educational system and our business model system, which said that family is not a priority, it's just an aside because we have to put up with antiquities. But the main thing is to become wealthy, prosperous, successful, prominent, etc. And you sacrifice everything along the way. Or you put the family on as a model. Like all your politicians have model families. They don't have real families. They have model families. Like the husband and the wife are sleeping around all the time. They hate each other's guts. But because of the revenues of him being a lying, snaky, surreptitious politician, they both will be willing to stand in front of the camera and smile even when he gets caught with his hand in the cookie jar. Because this is all about money. See, these are uncouth people, unprincipled people, unprincipled. And if that type of attitude and spirit enters into a man or a woman in the context of marriage, the marriage is virtually over unless she gets converted, he gets converted, and gets actually saved. Not religious, saved. And so it's important to know that in the 21st century where you and I are, endeavoring to be married really requires believing God and believing that God's way is right when it comes to marriage. That's a fundamental presupposition with which I am encouraging you guys to come to the class, that God designed marriage, that God told us how it works, and that God is right. And by God's grace, I'm going to employ the biblical principles of marriage so that I can have a decent marriage. Otherwise, I can expect my marriage to hit the rocks like everybody else's because I'm no better than my fellow man. And that's the honest goodness truth. Proverbs chapter 31 deals with the virtuous woman in verse 10, but I want you to correct that. And it's not necessarily to be corrected in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, the word woman is often the same word for wife. So woman, wife in the Hebrew, there are no real distinctives there. So in this text, when you hear about the virtuous woman, verse 10, it should be the virtuous wife because the whole thing is about the relationship in the context of marriage in Proverbs 31. This is not just about a woman who gets down in her business. This is about a married woman who gets down in her business. This is about a married woman who gets down in her business. This is a married woman with a man who gets down in her business. This is a married woman with a man and children getting down in her business. Is that all right for me to frame it that way? This is a sister who has children and she's getting down in her business with a husband and children. That's the right picture to paint. That's the right picture to paint. Because if we simply draw out the virtues and attributes of this woman, you can apply them to the single woman. You can apply them to the business woman. You can apply them to the business woman slash wife who is more business woman than she is wife. That's how they do that. They dichotomize this and applaud her for being able to be a CEO and CFO and all this in business when her home is completely deplorable. But that's not the picture that God paints. So I want us to look at the virtues because I've enumerated them fundamentally in your outline of Proverbs 31, 10 through 31, verses 10 through 31. And verses 10 through 12 underscore the first and primary reason why this is a virtuous woman. Verses 10 through 12 underscore the first and primary reason for which she is a virtuous woman. Do you guys see your outline? Here's the reason. She honors her husband. She honors her husband. You guys see that outline? I just want to make sure you get that, because when we read verses 10 through 12, you're going to see what I say, why I say that. That this has to be at the top of your list, ladies. Honoring your husband. God says she's a virtuous woman and that her price is far above rubies. Now, rubies don't mean anything in America, 21st century America, but in the Middle East, they did then and they do now. Rubies are very precious commodities in the Middle East. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her. See verse 11? The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he shall have no need of spoil. Do you guys see that? That means she is not a demerit to his calling. She doesn't take away from his calling so that he has to supply the needs of his calling from some other source. She does not operate against him. She operates for him. Do you guys see that? A virtuous woman operates for her spouse. In theology, we call this a complement. A complementarian relationship. She complements him. That's biblical. Now, the anti-biblical model that dominates our culture today is called an egalitarian relationship. Egalitarian, meaning equal without distinction, and therefore, as a basic premise, is set in opposition and hostility towards the spouse, so that they are always fighting for power against each other. That's your model in the world today. And essentially, the model is actually tilted more to the woman, because every movie, every play, every theatrical scheme, every projection of the male today in the world is viewed as the man being dumb and stupid and slow and unskillful and unable to provide. And he accepts that role gladly. He just takes on the buffoon role and accepts it. That somehow, because we're doing this tit for tat in the 21st century, where because there were for millenniums, the woman has been misogynized, that is, beat down and relegated to irrelevance, that in this present culture of liberal progressive thought, the goal is to affirm the woman. This is the swinging of what we call the perilous pendulum, where the pendulum has swung to the side of the patriarchal model of oppression and subjugation of the woman to the point of non-existence, as you have some of that still going on in the Middle East. The pendulum has swung in the context of what is called secular humanist freedom to the other side, where the woman is now put on a pedestal. She's a pedestal. She is actually deified. I've talked to us about female gods. We are in a female god deification mode. We have been for 100 years. And what the Gnostics say and what the New Agers say is we're about to go into the full-blown Aquarian Age. Do you guys understand what that means? That means that females will be the ones running the world. And they're positioning them that way now. You guys know that. They're positioning them that way now. Now, I'll tell you, I learned this back in the 80s, and I told my wife when God had given us six daughters, I told my daughters, I told them this when they were 4 and 5 years old. I said, girls, I want to let you know that you must think biblically as you grow. I want you to think biblically as you grow, because you're going to be flattered by the world. My daughters were 6, 7, 8 years old, 10 years old. I said, girls, I want you to know when you hit that age where your teachers start telling you, all you need to do is talk to this teacher. All you need to do is get this grant. All you need to do is get this scholarship. Go down this road. You will be successful in life. Every door that opens up for you will be a door that essentially will denigrate the man and raise the woman and put her up on a pedestal, so that if you're not careful, by the time you're an adult, you will hate men. That's right. It's sown into your system. It's a tacit acceptance of being, remember what we said about the three categories of man's being, spirit, soul, and body, and that in the soul category that we seek to be affirmed, and women get affirmed in college like nothing else today. Am I telling the truth? affirm to the detriment of the brothers. Do you know right now when I say brothers, I'm talking about all my brothers, all ethnic groups. Do you know right now college is 70 to 80% women today, that our men are not making it into college. And the purveyors of information act as if they don't know why that's the case. When what we understand concerning how the process works, our men have been intentionally inhibited from the time of their youth. They have been placed in classes, told that they were slow and unable and not given the qualities and skill sets for them to build into them confidence by which they can also attain degrees on a level of business and education and science and the arts as our sisters. Are you guys hearing what I'm saying? Me and my wife had to fight through this as my children were growing up, being African American, particularly my boys, had to fight through the presumption of the teachers who are all change agents. They are all change agents who think they have the God-given right to assign to your children their agenda in life. From the first grade. Put them in this class. My wife used to, because see, my wife is sharp. My wife is sharp. One thing my wife got that I get a little scared of is her aggressiveness. Now, she said, Jesse, it's assertiveness. Yeah, well, it's assertiveness in an aggressive way. Because she don't play when it comes to her babies. And I just trail her behind her because I told you we met in martial arts, so she can get down. I'll get down right behind her. But you can trail the way, sister. Trail the way when it comes to our kids. She did not play with our kids. Because if they could, none of our kids would have been in a position to go to college. If they could have did it. You hear what I'm saying? If they could have did it, none of our kids would have been in a position to go to college. This is where your eyes have to be wide open. The virtuous wife would have known about this. She would have been able to study all of the criterion, all of the statistics. She would have been able to see all this going. Because see, God gives you wisdom when you want to do the right thing. If you really want to do it God's way, God will give you wisdom. He will open your ears. You'll be just going through the store. He'll open your ears. He'll show you a book. He'll let you listen to a conversation. And then all of a sudden, he'll send you down. See, God shoots arrows to teach us too, doesn't he? He'll shoot an arrow, and then you go down that course. My wife will be sitting up for hours at night investigating things and realizing what the school systems are doing. And we navigate through that stuff, make sure our kids get the best opportunity at college as possible. Did a good job. Did a good job. Still fighting. Still fighting that battle. God blesses it when the woman honors her husband. Verses 10 through 12. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he shall have no need of spoil. Verse 12. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. You guys see that? She will do him good, not evil, all the days of her life. Do you know that that alone returns men to rest mode every time they think about their wife? Men are put in a rest mode when they think about a wife that they know, no matter what she's doing, she's going to never tear me down. She's going to never do anything that's going to destroy our relationship or destroy our home, because we're out here fighting. Men are in fight mode. I don't have time tonight. I told you I was going to talk to you about the biological nature of sin and how God makes us. He makes men and women slightly different, not a whole lot different, slightly different. So when we talk about biological distinctions between men and women, they are distinctions that are there based upon what God has called us to do. Men have always been designed in a way that they have always had to be the provider. And because they have had to be the provider, emotionally and psychologically, they have always had to be engaged in fight mode, on watch, hyper alert, in a watchful fashion, because that's what was required to go out and hunt and bring home the bacon. That's the natural predisposition of men. They are used to alarms. They are used to trouble. Because they have to go out there and deal with that trouble. And God made us where our alarm stays up for long periods of time once it gets initiated. As soon as you go that way, I'm up. I'm up until everything is settled. And that's in our physiology. That can be true in women too. Only in this sense. When a family is raggedy and the kids from the smallest days have to fight for their own sisters and brothers, then our sisters are just as amped as our brothers are. Am I making some sense? But in the context of a normalcy pattern where mom and dad are in the home and the kids can grow up in a safe environment, dad is going to be the one whose ears are up and always thoughtful about the windows being closed, the doors being locked, and everybody in the house at a certain time, cars positioned just right, pistol cocked, all that. All that. Y'all go to sleep, don't worry. Up in the middle of the night taking a walk through the house because that's what we do. Because that's what we do. My children and my wife cutting wood. I'm walking through the house. But that's what we do. Settle on down, go back to sleep. Says cool. Got one ear open. That's just the natural. But there are some demerits with that. But I'm just telling you, those things are there because God made us that way. I couldn't understand how my wife could sleep so good when there was danger around. Yeah, I just rub on her back 2 or 3 times. She gone. Deep RAM sleep. Deep ROM sleep. Deep ROM sleep. You know. I learned, you know, she just resting because her man's watching. That's a good idea. That's a good thought. And if her man's got to watch, she would say, like, why you and I both got to watch? If you want to watch, you watch. Look at verses 12 through 15. She will do him good, not evil, all the days of her life. She seeketh wool and flax and worketh willingly with her hands. Verse 13. She seeketh wool and flax and worketh willingly with her hands. There is a lot in that verse that is worth deriving for your own personal character building, ladies, but just a couple things that can be brought out of it. Certainly in your outline 12 through 15, we'll look at verse 14 and 15. It says, skills she has designed to build her home. Do you see that? She has skills. The sister got skills to build her home. And so in verses 13 through 15, this woman has the ability to distinguish between quality goods and pragmatic goods, seeking wool. That's a pragmatic good. Flax was a more luxurious good. And she works willingly with her hands. That means she's not lazy. That means she's not, you know, doesn't have a welfare recipient predisposition. You know, when I was growing up, the one thing that I used to marvel at in the hood growing up was we'd be getting up, going to school, 6, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. We come home early for break. We see these women rocking around with their robes on and their slippers and curlers in their hair. What they've been doing all day long? That's the mentality of the welfare person because they haven't been taught to be diligent to build up the home. Now, that kind of person is going to be a gossip. That person is going to tear down their house. You know what the proverb says? A foolish woman teareth down her house with her own hands. With her own hands. And that woman is going to do it because she's lazy, aimless. She's going to be a gossip. Do you hear me? She doesn't have the virtue necessary to realize that every home has to constantly be in building and in repair. Every home has to be in constant rebuilding or building and repair. You guys notice we're in a fallen world, right? Which means that things have to be built up all the time. Just when you do something and get the house squared away, stuff falling apart again. And once you get the material things in order a little bit, then all of a sudden your body parts are falling apart. Isn't that true? So we're fighting to build a house. We're fighting to build our bodies. Then our kids start to turn teenagers. And once they turn teenagers, all kind of stuff is dropping. My daughter wanted it. My second to my last daughter. I got one more daughter to go. Trinity. One more daughter. Hallelujah. One more daughter to go. My 16-year-old, she's 17 now. She reminds me this every day. She's 17. But last year, she wanted to make sure that she had a car for high school. This is her senior year. I don't know what that is. I don't know what that is. She just wanted a car. Really what it was is my 16-year-old, as I actually employ all these rules in my own relationship with my kids, my 16-year-old is a very diligent girl. She is very self-sufficient. And she despises having to depend on anybody to take her anywhere, including her parents. So she worked last year, summer school, I mean summer work, after school, away from us, saved up a couple thousand dollars to buy her a car, found her a car. All she needed me to do was drive her over there to get it. She didn't even need me to do nothing else. Dad, I don't need you to do anything but drive me over there to get it. I was so happy for her. She got her car, drove her car for 6 months. You know, she's a 16-year-old, so she ain't making a lot of money. Her transmission just died on her a couple days ago. So Daddy is there to help. And I'm going to help her, too. I'm going to encourage her to continue to be the way that she is. Because to be that way is going to prepare her to be a great help to her spouse. If he's not intimidated by her skill sets. That's a whole nother story. Look at it. Her skills are designed to build her home. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. I used to complain with Barb about how far she drove to get a deal. Did I step in it, brother? I didn't go there. Did I go there? You all right? You okay? Okay. You okay? You know, we have a tendency to think through two different prisms, right? I say, now, Barb, I know that's on sale for 50 cents cheaper, but you're going 8 miles to get it. None of that stuff registers. So, fellas, leave it alone. Because it's the fundamentals of the issue that matters. She would actually be able to prove that that's just one thing out of 300 things I had to buy that day, that if you added it all up, not only did I save more than the gas money that got me there, but I was also able to buy you that steak that you like every month with the extra savings. She would have been right. Because what I did after about 15 years of watching my wife, because I had to take about 15 years to watch her, it was 13 years into our marriage that I started understanding what I'm sharing with you now. 13 years into our marriage. We've been married 30 years in a couple weeks now. So for 17 years, I have been actually building this thesis and learning how to understand my wife, how she acts, why she does what she does. Before that time, it did not register. I just thought she was doing things differently than I was, and they didn't seem pragmatic. But over the years, I've come to understand how practically wise she has been. But I shouldn't have been surprised. She was willing to have 8 children for me. And, you know, she didn't marry a brother with a PhD. She married a blue-collar working brother who hustled. But we were robbing Peter to pay Paul constantly. So she had to finagle the money. And she's become extremely good at it. And I thank God that she didn't break out of her mode of operation to do what I said. Even though, you know, we had our battles, as you guys all know. She's like a merchant ship. She brings her fruit from afar. She rises also while it is yet night. In the Hebrew, the word night can be anything from nighttime to 6 o'clock in the morning. Okay, I just want you to know that. It doesn't mean that she's up at 2 o'clock in the morning. You're 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning, early. And give meat to her household and a portion to her maidens. That means she's able to provide to make sure that everybody has what they need for the next day's task. She considers a field, she buys it, and with the fruit of her hand, she plants a vineyard. Now, this woman is not only able to take money and purchase the things that are necessary for the home, but she's also able to make her money reproduce. Because that's the concept there. Think about this. I've segued into a whole nother concept that's in the back of my mind. I understand where we're going as a culture, and I realize that we are about to go into another phase of economic difficulty that we haven't been in for decades upon decades. This quantitative easing that's about to end, whether they throw in what is called a QE3 or QE4 quantitative easing third phase, where the feds print more money to throw into the economic system, which will create inflation. It will destroy the dollar. But it will keep us going, but it won't actually increase the quality of our life. It won't increase the quality of our life, which means to do quantitative easing, the metaphor is like this. America is a plane that's crashing slowly. Quantitative easing allows the plane to go through. It's on empty. It's just coasting and it's going through the woods, and a wing will get lost here, a wing will get lost there, and over the process of that descent, we are going to actually crash, but the crash doesn't have to be completely catastrophic if we can make the adjustments between what is called quantitative easing and the mystery of a recovery of our economic situation, given all of the global elements that have to be brought into play. But we are not going to recover back to the days of the middle 90s or early 2000 for another 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 years, and particularly not California. So we're going to be going through some hard times. So we're going to have to learn how to be more frugal than we already are. And part of what the challenge for us at this present time is, ladies and gentlemen, is that many of us have not been frugal for the last 10, 20 years. We bought into the debt system, and we started buying things because we were catering to our soul, not to our spirit. And so what God is doing now is bringing the whole nation into a fasting mode. We are fasting. Fasting from the image of materialism, the fig leaf of materialism, because it hasn't been good for us to be operating in a debt mode. And so some of us are going to learn through this period of what they call, this year is just an austere period, a time of austerity. We're going to learn how to manage money. How frugal would it be for people who are used to going to Costco and Safeway and Lucky's to buy everything, depending on somebody else to grow it, produce it, package it, ship it, and store it, to you learning how to take the seeds and plant them in the ground yourself, produce your own vegetables? Like our grandparents used to do. Am I telling the truth? Like our grandparents used to do. We need to be getting back there anyway. Do you know how much money you would save if you was eating your own vegetables? Yeah. See, and listen, if our minds don't change, we will stay broke. Because the goal of the system is to keep the middle class strangled right now. It's not going to let the middle class emerge. And the poor people are growing exponentially. So if you don't think it through, the proverb says the poverty of the poor is their destruction. The poverty of the poor is their destruction, meaning poor people think poor, and as a consequence of poor thinking, they can't extricate themselves out of their situation. The only way you and I enter into halfway decent lifestyles is if we think it through, and then we apply effort to obtain skill sets that allow us to have the revenues to live a halfway decent life. But that requires sacrifice and a lot of labor, doesn't it? But that won't happen if our minds don't change. All we'll do, as the proverb says, is sit around. As the proverb says, the slothful won't even raise his hand to his mouth to feed himself. You know you pathetic when somebody fix your plate, set it in front of you, and you say, I need somebody to take a spoon and stick it in my mouth now, because I don't even have enough strength to lift it from. But that's what a welfare mentality is all about. And that was designed to destroy certain cultures. And it did it. It did it. This woman wouldn't let that happen for nothing in the world. I don't care if she was living on the seventh floor in the project. She would use the balcony to plant some potatoes and some greens and some squash and some cabbage. Am I telling the truth? My grandmama used to do it. Boy, I used to love that stuff. All right, let me go on a few more. Look at verse 17. She girded her loins with strength and strengthened her arms. Do you see that? God bless her. God bless her. God bless her. Now go to the gym, but don't stay in the gym, because it ain't about the gym. Do you see that? This is really a metaphor for her being able to operate as efficiently as possible to get this job done that she is arduously engaged in. Verse 18, she perceiveth that her merchandise is good, her candle goeth not out by night, she layeth her hands to the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff. You know what the language of this is all about. She's into clothing, isn't she? Again, that's just a metaphor. She stretches out her hand. She stretches out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reaches forth her hands to the what? In our outline, verses 17 says, she pursues wisdom and knowledge for this end, to be diligent in her business. Verse 20, she is benevolent and kind to others. Do you guys see that? Ladies, what this is a symbol of, when you meet people that are benevolent and kind to other people, you know what it means? That they're not stuck on themselves. When you are narcissistic and stuck on yourself, you don't see any need but your own need. And even if you are aware of other people's needs, you are emotionally insensitive to them. Her disposition is, I'm going to help these people out for one reason. I have it. And I have the skill set to get it. See, there are a lot of people who don't even know how to work. That's one of the things about an austere period of time, which is really good. I remember back in the 80s, we had about middle 80s, late 80s, we had about five kids at that time, and I lost my job, and it was just like now, where when you lose your job, finding another job is so difficult. It is enormously difficult. And for about 6 to 8 months, I was without work. I was doing the unemployment thing, looking for jobs. It is humbling to be on unemployment. Because you got to go out looking for work, and you know there's a bunch of work that you don't want to look for, and you got to lie on the paperwork. You know you lie on the paperwork. All right, we'll pray about that at the end. But you, especially for those of you who are unemployed. You're lying on the paperwork because you're actually looking for a better job than the one. You got to go into Jack in the Box and McDonald's to get an application telling you, you know. It's humbling, isn't it? You know what's humbling? Humbling is the lack of character, a virtue, a quality that would have made you the exception to the rule when the boss had to fire a whole bunch of people. But you were presumptuous that your job was secure, but it wasn't because you weren't diligent and God had to teach you you weren't diligent. You know how arrogant we are? Lose our job because we're not diligent, thinking that you're exception, but you're not the exception. That other cat's the exception. The one that wasn't running off at his mouth so much. He was taking care of business. He was there early, left late. You running out there because you wanted to play ball or whatever the case was. So austere times are times where we have to see ourselves and see what we are. And then we make a change. During the 80s, I labored working two jobs to take care of my family. And I realized that entrepreneurism is the way out when the national system is going through a shakedown. Entrepreneurism is the way out when the national system is going through a shakedown. If you don't want to be trapped by the national system shakedown, because it's shaking off all the dead leaves, getting rid of all the bad businesses, you have to become an entrepreneur. You have to know how to see where the money is. My eyes were open, wide open, once I was a mechanic for many years. And the mechanic field dried up, and I lost my job as a mechanic. And I didn't want to go back into your shade tree mechanic job because I was working at the upper echelon in your dealerships, working on all of the fancy cars, Mercedes-Benz and BMWs and Audis and Porsches. I didn't want to go work for these dirty yards. I just didn't. $8, it wasn't going to take care of six kids. So I said, you know, I'm not going to do it. And a couple of guys that were entrepreneurs peeped me to the game of the cleaning industry. They said, man, you can make more money cleaning carpets, cleaning windows, taking on janitorial jobs than you ever would as a mechanic. And it took me 1 year to learn the system, and they were absolutely right. So when our Hispanic brethren are walking around and say, si, señora, a mí no habla inglés, they're making $200 a day, $300 a day. Am I telling the truth? Smiling. Making $300 a day, smiling at you, taking out the garbage and working till 2 and 3 and 4 in the morning, making $300 a day, $1,500 a week, $6,000 a month, add it up, $72,000 a year. Whoa! They ain't even got a car. They don't even speak English, but they know how to do it. Are you hearing what I'm saying? And people who are not open to the game can't even see it. But this woman sees it. She sees it. Give me a few more minutes of your time. She actually sees it. She stretches out her hand to the poor. She reaches forth and hands forth her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household. My goodness. Do you see that? She is not afraid of the snow. You know what that means? Hard times. Where everybody else is going to stay in the house because it's too cold or snowing out there, she's going to get on out there and take care of it. The snow don't bother her. It doesn't bother her one bit. She can sew clothes together. Remember, she got us some wool and some flax. So she looking good while she's going through the snow, taking care of her business. Everybody else shivering in the house, and she out taking care of business. But there's more implied here. You know what's more implied? And this here can be understood. Because she's frugal, because she has foresight, because she has insight, she actually is like the ants. She's stored up in the summer for the winter. So she can kick back with her nice little socks on, her scarf on at the fireplace because she just stored up her money. Waving at the other folks as they go by trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents. Her and her family are well taken care of. It's called foresight. That's just typical diligence. Typical diligence on the part of a woman. No wonder her husband safely trusts in her. Right? No wonder he safely trusts in her. Watch this. Verse 21. She's not afraid of the snow for her house. All her household are clothed with scarlet. Do you see that? They dress well. She maketh herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. Interesting, these verses that are describing the quality, character, and color patterns of the material that she has actually puts her in a category of being what we call a middle class, upper middle class person who has done well for herself. She's just done well. Yes, ma'am. And we're not done yet, but you see it, huh? Going through the sea, huh? Yeah. And watch this. She maketh herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. Her husband is known in the gate. See that? Her husband is known in the gate. The gate is where everything was deliberated. The gate is where the judiciary was. The gate is where the businessmen were. The gate is where commerce is taking place. He is a businessman himself. He's known in the gate, and she's known in the gate. When he sits among the elders of the land, she maketh fine linen and sells it, delivers girdles unto the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. Now watch this. What is her clothing? It's not her clothes. It's strength and honor. Character. That's a small commodity today. Everybody's all about the flesh, all about appearances, all about productivity. And she shall rejoice in what? Time to come. Oh, look at verse 25, the latter part. Mark this. Her rejoicing is in time to come. It's not now. It's in time to come. Do you see that? In other words, she's not making her boast in what she can do in this life. She's doing what she's doing by the grace of God, but her reward comes later. Ooh, that's a secret to strength, isn't it? Because you know what we're going to have in this life? We're going to have ups and downs in this life. We're going to have ups and downs in this life. But the man or the woman whose hope is in the Lord, who's fixed on the resurrection, is going to be able to make it through the storms because they have a clear beam on their ultimate objective, which is glory. Glory should be the motive. I think that's what I said to us when we first started class. I said, what is the motive for our marriage? What's the objective for our marriage? Glory. Glory should be the objective. If glory is not your objective, you're going to be very disillusioned by the trials of life. If glory is not your objective, you're going to be very disillusioned by the ebbs that come into our life. You know those periods where we both wake up as dead as a doorknob? With our heads on backwards and funky in our spirit. If you don't have your eyes fixed on glory, that can sink you. It can totally sink you. Glory has to be the motive for everything that we do because it's going to actually give us the impetus to make the right choice when it comes to what I do now will affect what happens later, even if it's a few years later. Like, for instance, with our children. One of the reasons in your outline I was saying she honors her husband. She pursues knowledge, wisdom and knowledge for this end that she might be diligent. She's benevolent and kind to others. She's brave. Her family is adorned by her labors. This woman really is, and you'll see this in points 27 through 31. This woman really is all about taking care of her home. Watch it. I got three more minutes. Our time is almost up. Watch this. Her strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. She's stuck on glory. She openeth her mouth with what? Wisdom. There is nothing more incongruent tend to meet a beautiful sister only to have her open her mouth and find out how backwards she is. Isn't that disappointing, brother? Isn't that disappointing? You go, man. Man! In fact, you lose your beauty if you're not a woman of strength and honor to a man of dignity. Men, once you get past the stereotypical, they're stuck on the physical, because the physical for men, I shared this with our group last Saturday, and I'll just say it now. This idea that men are from Mars, women are from Venus, only has a scintilla of truth. For the most part, it's a big lie. It really is. When you hear propositions from any circle, particularly the secular circle or the psychological circle, even if it's Christians using it, because psychology that's not rooted in biblical theology is a delusion as well. Psychology has to be rooted in biblical theology, or else it will set you up for the constant, unending battle of the sexes. The battle of the sexes is a constant, unending sort of seed, insipid in different concepts and ideas. Men and women are not that different. Men and women are not that different. We want the same thing. We really do want the same thing. We want peace. We want unity. My brother Heron said, he wrote down connection. That's a woman's word. When last time you had a brother say, I want to just connect with you. Us women talk like that, isn't that right? Well, I want connection. I agree with him. I don't want to be disconnected. I want connection too. I wish he would just understand me. Well, I want you to understand me too. Isn't that the argument now? What you want, I want. You know, I want you to be able to appreciate me. Well, I want you to appreciate me too. See what I'm getting at? This conflict is about the same issues. Respect and appreciation and connection, all that. We all want that. It's critical to our health. I'll talk about that down the line. The reason why people end up in flight mode is because it's killing them physically. You can't have an unending relationship with somebody that's always, when you're always in fight mode, it's going to destroy you. It's going to destroy you physically. You want to live long and be healthy and happy. Have a relationship that is cordial, respectful, biblical, complementary. And you're going to live long. You're going to live long and be healthy when you operate out of a paradigm where you come together. Where you can, what we're supposed to do is produce a rest mode. When I come into the presence of my wife, I want to be able to rest. When she comes into my presence, I want her to be able to rest when she comes into my presence. Be able to just rest. We should be able to have for each other a refuge. My wife should be a sanctuary for me. And I should be a sanctuary for her. Does that make for good logic? I need to be able to flee to my wife for refuge. Lay on her bosom and rest. She openeth her mouth in wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of what? There it is. Ladies, learn how to be kind with your operate out of a law of kindness. Now you can do that when your heart is full of wisdom. Because you can tell people things. You know, you can help people. Isn't it nice to be able to know how to help people, to be able to say things, a word to the wise, to the weary, in due season? She looks well to the ways of her household. See verse 27? That's the compendium. And she eats not the bread of what? Her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and praiseth her. Here, this is how you know you're doing all right, ladies, when your children and your husband praise you. That's what you want. That's what you want. You want the praise of your husband and your children. Many daughters have done virtuously, but you excel them all. Verse 30. Favor is deceitful. Do you guys see that? And beauty is what? Better know it. But a woman that fears the Lord, she shall be what? Now that's true of every woman that's married who have these priorities in her catalog of service. She honors her husband. Her skills are designed to build her house. So in your outline, operational goals of marriage, I'm going to just say those three things that are at the top. And you can carry this all the way over to the Church of the Living God. We won't expand on that today, but you'll hear it from me in the pulpit, because the church is the bride of Christ, and we should be as prolific and as dignified and as industrious and fruitful as this woman of Proverbs 31. Isn't that true? The Church of the Living God should be as industrious, prolific, fruitful, and dignified as this woman of Proverbs 31. The operational goals of marriage are simple. The glory of God. That's our prime motive. Is this action that I'm about to engage in honorable? That should be always asked with regards to anything that we do. Does this honor God? Does this honor my husband? Does this honor my wife? Does this honor my children? Does it promote unity? You guys see that? Does it promote? Whatever endeavors you engage in, you need to ask the question, will this promote unity among us? Will it enhance our love? Will it increase our harmony, peace, stability, the glory of God? Point number two, the practical efforts that go in. This is not the motive. This is the practical efforts that go into it. We'll expand more on this when we work through position two, combining position two with position three. Because, we're working. Proverbs 31 is a very practical outline. The practical efforts. When we go about our task, are we operating in a cooperative mode? Is it actually unifying, harmonizing, and edifying us? So here's the prohibition. Never work against each other. Never work against each other. As soon as you take on a position where you are operating contrary to your husband, just call yourself a fool. As soon as you are taking on a behavior pattern or conduct where you're operating in conflict with your spouse, call yourself a fool. There is no way that you can uphold the institution of marriage when you are operating contrary to your spouse. It can't happen. Never. Just call yourself a fool. Just say, I'm getting ready to destroy God's institution. I'm intentionally going to destroy this institution by what I'm about to do. Never work against each other. Do nothing that threatens the relationship. Nothing that threatens the relationship. Avoid selfish agendas which undermine these objectives. Our families should be testimonies, redemptive and gospel orientation should dominate our household. If somebody were to look at me and observe my life and contemplate the fact that I have a wife and eight children, how would their looking at me point them to Christ? Right? How would their looking at me point them to the Master? Remember, marriage is a type of what? Christ in the church. So see how important it is that if you don't put it together, if you don't put it together, no way will a person see Christ. No way will they see Christ if you two don't put it together. There's no way that they can launch from you individually to Jesus when you're married, but you're operating in a single mindset. It doesn't work. See what I'm getting at? So I'm bound by a larger model in regards to my family, that whatever I do, it has to be consistent with pointing men to Christ. It has to be a corollary to, it has to be ancillary to, it has to augment the redemptive goals of God in Christ. I'm not doing anything that does not do that. I'm wasting my family's time, I'm wasting God's time if I don't operate out of that mode. When people meet me anywhere, wherever they meet me, in recreation or in work, how is this going to be an easy access into the gospel? Right? So how your family doing? Man, my family doing good. My wife doing this. My children doing this. How's the church doing? The church is doing well, man. We're growing and we got our struggles. We got our challenges. But by the grace of God, they're all coming under the gospel. My teenage kids are under the gospel. My grown children, even my grandbabies now are sitting under the gospel. I'm thankful God's been merciful to a brother. Undeserving mercy, but merciful to a brother. It's a gospel testimony. Am I telling the truth, Brother Matt? See, And that's what you sow to. That's, you sow to that. You sow to that. She looks for her reward to come. Right? To come. This Sunday, we're going to be able to praise you guys for Mother's Day. I love doing Mother's Day because I love my mother. My mother went through hell to raise three knucklehead boys all by herself because we grew up in the hood. So you know the story, right? So I love praising our mothers because they are worthy of it. But I love for my wife to be praised by her children because she gets to just get showered by her children after all that hard work she went through. Many times, Miss Barbara was on the brink of giving up. Are you hearing me? On the brink of giving up. Now she gets to bask in the blessings of daughters and sons-in-laws and grandchildren just pouring on her the blessing and thanksgiving of not giving up. Not giving up. It's a blessing. It's a real blessing. All right. I'm ready to close in prayer, but I just feel like before we do, if there's anything we need to talk about that's personal with us, bring to the table, pray about, deal with. Remember what I said when we first started the class. I don't mind teaching because I understand the anointing and how the anointing blesses when the teaching goes forth and the heart is filled with knowledge and the mind is expanded, there's challenging, convicting insights given to us, I don't mind it. But if there's something that we need to deal with that's pressing, we are a family. This is our group. We can bring it to the table and address it now, and we can pray about it and ask God to deliver us if we got issues. I mean, we all got issues. But if we need something to be brought to the light so that it can be healed, we have that opportunity now. Whatever it may be, I don't want any of you going home with the enemy taking advantage of you by putting up a wall between you two, because that's hypocrisy. That's not what we came here for. Any problem can be fixed if we bring it to the light and we take it to Calvary. And we ask for the healing power of the Spirit of God. Any problem can be fixed. Any problem.
This is my favorite. So I was divorced before. I had to do a lot of the safeguarding of the I guess I was out of my role because I was being both mom and sometimes I feel I have more of a propensity, use your word, to check the windows and the doors and just kind of be that. But he gets mad at me because I don't like my car door. Because, like, I protect my kids, but I don't care about stuff. And so I don't carry it over to that. And he's more, you know, like you said, safeguard things. How do you work between things and people?
Is that the only thing that you want to bring to the table? That particular conflict related to your being comfortable, not worried about things versus just worried about the family? Is that the core of it? Because I want to be able to be economical here. Or is there
something? I think it's also true that I just feel that business-wise, when I make decisions, I think I make them for the family, and I feel sometimes he just makes it. He lets me in, but he doesn't let the rest of the family into that same mindset. Like, I have a daughter, and I know he loves
at
her.
At home?
I have one at home.
Okay. Oh.
I have 16. Very difficult.
Okay.
And I know he loves me, so he's trying to love her. But sometimes I feel like I'm being stuck in the middle, trying to
reconcile.
Yeah, make sure that she's respectful, but he's not always disciplined. But I would love him to love her more.
Okay. How long have you guys been together?
We've known each other for 7 years, but we've only been married almost 2 years. 2 years old.
Okay. Now, your daughter is 17, 16, so you know she's going through her curve, right? that's essentially independent, although it's exacerbated by the fact that her biological dad is not in the home. So that category of difficulty has to be looked at on its own as not being a blight on you two. That's just the way that it is. So you have to respect her evolution. The 17-year-old? 16? Yeah. 16 can be extremely difficult. If we were doing counseling session, I would have to talk to you about what was the background with that. But if I was her stepdad, I would be extremely careful about how I approached her in relationship, because I would want to, I would not want her to misinterpret my my zeal for her welfare. And they can easily do that at 16. So what your husband is probably doing is simply being safe by channeling his efforts of unity through you versus through y'all, because that's a process that takes a long time, if ever, because of where she is in her age right now. So there's a lot of things that have to be unraveled in that category. But I can tell you what the what you must do if you're going to bless your baby. You two have to be able to operate out of these principles of unity and harmony, diligently making sure that there is no sense of threat, even in the context of conflict. We'll get to this down the line. We have to know how to deal with conflict. We're in conflict. I'm not actually telling you guys that we're going to learn the kind of skill sets where we can avoid conflict. I'm not doing that. I'm preparing us through the ideal how to deal with conflict so we can return to the ideal. Because part of perpetual conflict that breaks things is not having ideals. But we have ideals now, don't we? Not idea, ideals. Concepts that are rooted in biblical principles, a vision of how we want it to be. Do we have that now? So what I want to do is be able to handle my conflicts in a way that can restore the ideals or preserve the ideals. Because we're discovering by virtue of what we've written down about each other that we have some of those components there. So I want to continue building into that, right? But there's a lot of broken stuff that we're dealing with. So we'll be moving into the pragmatic aspect of conflict correction down the line so that we can develop the confidence that we can solve our challenges. Remember, turn your problems into challenges. Change the terminology, because the terminology defines the situation. If it's a problem, then it's unsolvable. I got to go outside of the house to get help. If it's a challenge, now my job is to learn how to resolve it. God puts that before me to build character in me and to strengthen me. So I got to get knowledge. Like what we're doing now is getting knowledge. Are we getting knowledge? I hope this is not an exercise in vanity. So in your situation, what you guys want to do is just work on more prudent communication skills and keep the big picture. We all get myopic. Like we'll have a vision of things encompassing all the important aspects. But once we go to talking, here's what we do. We get very narrow-minded. We start doing like this. And so now it's just me and you talking. And everybody else is watching, and they feel excluded, and they are excluded because we become more myopic. So I need to talk with my periphery broad enough to be inclusive of everybody in the household, so I am not threatening any of the children by our disagreement. Like, we can have a disagreement, but we have to learn how to put disagreements in their proper context, deconstruct those disagreements together, following certain rules, and then resolve those disagreements. We can do that. We can disagree in a manner that exalts God. Because the conflict that you guys are having is simply an opportunity for you to learn more about each other. Because you don't know enough about him. And he doesn't know enough about you. Because if you did, you'd be more aware of why he is prone to want to protect those things. And it wouldn't be a conflict for you. It might be a difference of values, but it wouldn't be a conflict. You guys understand what I mean? That just because a person has a difference of values than you do, it doesn't mean that it's a conflict. Differences do not necessarily constitute conflict. And I'm insecure or naive if I think that differences always constitute conflict. They don't. And sometimes those differences are merely augmentations. Remember, a complementarian relationship is two different people combining their differences in order to make it work. And so why is there a virtue in him wanting to make sure that the car is locked. Let me investigate that. Let me see if I can think that through. And we can talk about that more down the line. Okay? But what's your name, my sister? TJ and my brother? Curtis. You guys' last name? The Robinsons. Keep my brother and sister Robinsons in your prayers. These are small issues. Small issues. But it's always rooted in weak or flawed communication. We can solve that. It's a done deal. And I'm glad to see you out, my brother, every time. It's a joy to have you out. It is. Huh? I hear you. It's a struggle, my brother.
Yes, I got a lot of broken items, but I don't want to give it to that. But is there a such thing as grieving something? I know it's a right and wrong for grieving, but is there a certain part in your life where you get to where you just grieve the situation and move on? Is there a right or wrong with that?
Mm-hmm. No, there's a right of grieving something that you can't fix because it's not meant to be fixed. There's a right of grieving it because you care about it. When you grieve, you value something, right? But you also, when you grieve, you are basically relegating that situation to a done deal. You guys know how to close out things and keep moving? Are you people that keep all the files open in your life? All the files. There are some folk who keep a dozen files open. They've been open for 20 years. When they don't have anything to do, they go into those files. It drives me crazy. Isn't that terrible? But if you are forward-thinking people, forward-headed people, forward-driven people, you can close that file, give it to God, and move forward, and you don't have to feel like you're neglecting something. You can do that. You can do that. You can do that. Does that help, my brother? Yeah, you can do that. You can definitely do that because we're forward. We got to go forward. We got to go forward, definitely. Brother LaValle and Brother Charlie.
I don't know how to word it, but it looks like to me there's a seed about to take place in our misunderstanding here is how to help our relatives and friends, most of our immediate family, which is I have two stepdaughters who we really pray for and want to see them saved. But they're in the condition where they're in their early 20s and they're going through difficulties. But we are trying to help them at the same time, so I'm just thinking that, well, we're giving them some help, but where do you stop giving them the same help so they can realize that they're in a crucial situation and where they have to get up and move? Stop bringing the silver spoon to the mouth, you know, and let them just move on forward, and us holding back, but not holding back to the point where we're not loving each other, like you have discussed in Friday class, loving one another, as Jesus said,
mm-hmm.
And even though they're not in the Word of God, they may not know what that is, but since we are being taught, how do we practice that? With them, I mean, they're being immediate.
Two daughters?
Yeah.
Families?
Yeah.
Husbands and wives?
They're not married.
They're not married.
But they're living with their boyfriends. Yeah. They have
they're
two
living
children.
Each. Huh?
They have two children.
Are they in your house or are they in their own house?
No, they're in their house. No.
And what are they doing? Asking for money to supplement
constantly,
their life?
Constantly. Yeah. I need money for this. And
now, have you been able to sit them down to talk to them about the reason for which they are constantly asking for money and getting a real clear understanding that are they being opportunists or are they really, really hurting for money?
They are hurting for money. They're going to school too. Now they've decided to go back to school and they're doing well on that side and working part-time.
Well, my point to that was that as you give them the hope, and at the same time, you're advising them to take a certain direction.
Right.
In what regard?
In educating themselves and the relationship with their family. But the relationship between them, boyfriend and their children, how they had to bring them up and so on, is becoming really difficult to deal with. And
so what you're doing is mixing theology with the pragmatism non-covenantal family? Are you trying to bring theology into the equation?
Well, that's the confusion I'm having because I don't want to have an argument with my wife about it. Because
what does the theological component have to do with the pragmatic elements of them
paying the bills and getting through school?
I guess we just want to apply our theology and get her to understand the biblical ways.
Well, get them to understand.
They don't understand that what they're doing is wrong?
Perhaps not, because they love what they're doing. You know, they just over and over stick with what they're doing. And
you mean the fornicating state, non-marital state? Yeah, they know they're fornicators, though. They're not. They grew up in America. They know. Right? They know. So the thing that you do is when you designate benevolence to our loved ones who are just heathen, because they are, they're just living like hell, we're designating benevolence to them because we care about the grandchildren, and we don't want the grandchildren to have to suffer because of their delinquency. But we've already told them, you need Christ.
Right.
I'm sure you told them. I'm sure you told them, without a doubt.
I'm sure, really.
So my point is this. It's difficult with loved ones who don't follow the gospel, but you can't use money as a cudgel to get them to embrace theology. Never do it. But what you can do is tell them, this is how we're going to ration our help to you, and at a certain point, it's going to diminish. But even then, the diminishing of those resources to them has to be predicated upon or based upon a real virtue in yourself. Let's say I'm a multimillionaire and they're struggling, and those are my daughters, and they got their heads on backwards. I want to kill everybody because I want them to really be saved, but I love them. I'm going to take care of them. I'm going to take care of them because I have the resources. Right? Right? I'm going to take care of them because I have the resources. This woman gave to the poor. They're poor. They're poor in their mind. They're poor in their conduct. I'm going to take care of them because I have the resources. What good is money if you don't use it to this end? What good is it? Are you guys understanding what I'm saying? What good is it? And so what happens is you and I get tested with winning them over by a Christ-like goodness that almost seems like they're taking advantage of us. Right? Is that true? Is that true? See, somehow we want to like really put law on it, like law is going to bring them in. But it's only grace that's going to bring them in. So here's how this goes. This is what I meant by becoming myopic instead of having a broader periphery. God is sovereign. God is providential. God controls all things, right? God brings trouble. God brings blessing. The Bible is very clear about the ways of a transgressor are what? The hard times coming, aren't they? They're coming. All you got to do is wait for them to get harder and harder because it's coming. And at some point when the troubles are so hard that they know that the answer is not found in mom and daddy and grandmama, granddaddy, that they got to go to God, they'll remember the persistent good that you bestowed upon them on top of the gospel. Because you didn't reject them while they were down. Don't do that. And you guys, you know, you deliberate the pragmatics of how you want to give it to them and where you need to cut short so that you don't let this get between you two. Don't let this get between you two. You see what I'm saying? This is where you pour out your benevolence on them because you care about the children. And you're praying for God to turn their hearts. Is that what we're doing? So then we're waiting on God, right?
I thought money would become a vehicle for them to just hang on instead of picking up.
No, because God's bigger than your money. Isn't God bigger than the money? Isn't God bigger than the money? Somebody know what I'm talking about. I've been there many times. God's bigger than the money. He's bigger than the money. You watch how God comes in. But the secret to God entering into our plans is you two being on the same page, on the same page. That's the secret. When we get to position three, I'll be talking about that. The mutual knowledge that we have to have of each other so that we can work in a complementary way to wage war against the enemy that has our children in bondage. God can restore every dime. That's not an issue. I know you're not even worried about that. Right? Does that help?
Yes.
Brother
John. On dealing with the conflict and the anxieties that you may have,
I can't hear you, brother. We got to get this on tape. What did you say?
I said, for someone that is dealing with anxiety.
Anxiety, okay.
And when you get into that conflict, you try to avoid it, but having it so long as a child and coming up with it, and you're in this covenant, and you don't want to, you know, get into the conflict based on, you know how weak you are in the marriages and not having the proper tools to think through these situations and anxiety flood you, overcoming you. How do you handle them situations?
Yeah, that's good. That's good right there. We don't have time to get into it too much tonight, but that's good. See, this is the stuff we need to be talking about. This is stuff. I'm not done. I didn't answer him yet. Because what he's talking about is wanting not. Brother Charlie wants to get back here. That's what he wants to do. He wants to get back here. He wants to get back in the rest mode. Now, I want you guys to mark what I'm about to say. You might be resting, but your spouse is not resting because you're resting. Okay? So you have to be able to identify when they're not resting and then do everything to accommodate a rest mode so you can solve the problem. It is no good to try to solve problems neglecting the fact that your spouse is stressed. And what that means is your spouse may be stressed based upon a history that has basically shaped their personality where stress is real easy. So I have to now just develop a pattern of entry into dialogue with my spouse where I don't push that stress button. Well, that's how my wife is. My wife does not like to be stressed at all. And so I have to actually come in at a right time and address the issue because her stress level goes up quick and that changes everything. But before I knew how to position one, look at her, see her for who she was, deconstruct her, understand her makeup, her propensities, her bents, her weaknesses, her strengths, and then realize that some of those weaknesses are long, protracted things that go way, way back, and they're not going away real quick. That means I'm going to walk in reality. I'm not going to just be opining the fact that she doesn't like to handle stress. Why would I opine that when that's deep down in her psyche? That's not going away for a long time. So that means I'm going to have to tone my voice down when I talk. I can be screaming and hollering at her. Because as soon as I raise the voice, stress level goes up. She starts to flood. Didn't I tell you about flooding? Did I tell you guys about flooding? Where the body starts just floating in that pool, just floating. You can't think about nothing because you're floating. There's nothing comfortable about floating in the pool, right? So we got to drain that pool and get our feet on the ground and work through things. So you and Sister Erica will have to develop a more effective form of communicating that allows you to not avoid issues that have to be dealt with, because avoidance is like a Band-Aid. So we have to work through better forms of communication. Down the line, as we go through the characters, we got the characters. Remember those, the 10 biblical characters in our outline we're going to be dealing with? When we get into those 10 biblical characters, they will cover some of these issues. And what I'm going to be asking you to do as you read those 10 biblical characters, and we're dealing with certain scenarios, how would you handle that scenario if your feet were in her shoes or in his shoes? And then we'll be able to answer some of this during that time. Okay? Anybody else before we close in prayer? Hold on, Brother Mario.
I just wanted to talk to you about one of my conflicts with my wife is my concern about her job. You know, she's a social worker, and I deal with kids who are have special needs before they get into that system of mental health. You know, as adolescents, and I see how violent they are. You know, as far as for staff and whatnot. And then I talked to her about, you know, some of the things that she did up there. And she just don't want me to worry about it. She thinks that I don't know what I'm talking about. You know, what I see is at the empty stage, you know, as far as, you know, violence, you know, and I just concerned at the time, you know, she just don't want me to worry about it. I try to you know.
What would you like her to do?
I just, you know, just more or less just be more aware of her surroundings, you know, not just comfortable and relaxed.
Now watch this. I'm going to take this and use this as a scenario. because I know Sister Don and Sister Mario, and this is a good model. Brother Mario's is in the watchful mode, hyper watchful. You got that? Way over here. Sister Don is in the laid back mode. That's her middle name, laid back. That's just true. Sister Don is laid back. These are two extremes. Now, for these two extremes to work together, they have to appreciate each other. Because otherwise, one is going to cancel out the other. Just by the laid back person will not appreciate the virtue of being careful. The careful person will not appreciate the quality of the individual who is relying upon providence. You have to reconcile the two. Because, see, this is not about any each of you individually. This is about you collectively. Anytime my spouse is worried about something, even though I'm not worried about it, I'm emotionally insensitive. Got it? So then we have to find a way to meet in the middle so that we can resolve this mutual conflict that was raised up by one person at least. I know I'm always telling my wife to be careful when she goes out the house. All the time. Because I've been in the streets. And she cruises. And all it takes is one time. One time. So all I need for her to do is say, okay, Jesse, I'll be careful. Done. And mean it. Because I'm going to look straight. I'm going to look through your eyes to your heart. You better mean that. You have to mean it. You have to mean it. You have to take what I said and treasure it. Because God can spank your butt good if you don't pay attention to your spouse. Am I telling the truth? You have to mean it. Because I'm not trying to do anything other than secure us by my efforts and my tone of saying be careful when you're out there. Social workers do get beat up, raped, and killed. You do know that, right? My Don knows that, but she's so laid back. Smooth operator. That's Don. Smooth operator. But you got to work that with hubby and mean it. All right. Let's see. I had one more hand up there.
I just had a question. I need some help because I have those first three horsemen that I struggle with that I didn't even realize, you know, was a part of my character until really coming to this class.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a lot of hypertension in those first three areas, and I'm trying to avoid getting to that fourth area, but I can see that kind of coming.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting comfortable in those first three areas of just doing life and just kind of locking things up and going about life.
So JR says that he's observing these three horsemen in his own life. He's critical, and he can be contemptuous in his thoughts about people, and he's certainly defensive when he's probably put on point himself. You can be
concerned of my wife, you know, those three areas.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you become defensive when she actually exposes something in you?
Yep.
Mhm. Yeah. Contempt would be an attitude that is willing to pour over into publicly degrading your life.
You don't. No, I don't do that. I just thought that because of how overly critical I am, mm-hmm. in my own mind, mm-hmm. I'm constantly mm-hmm. criticizing things that she does.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, internally, I'll hold that contempt against her.
Mm-hmm.
Although I won't publicize it,
right.
It's still there right. inside me.
What do you mean by contempt?
Like, basically, it's almost like losing respect because of the hypercritical thoughts that I have towards her.
Right.
And the constant unresolved
mm-hmm.
Basically just results in the contempt good. Against her.
Boy, you on your way to being healed. Yes, you are. And they've just been married for a couple years because God bless them. They've only been married for a couple years, and his wife has already become a mirror for him. Because our spouses, the sooner they become mirrors for us, the better. The sooner our spouses become mirrors, the better. If we go 10, 15, 20 years with what we see is only them and not ourselves in them, because he's saying he's seen himself. That, see, he'll be healed in no time. Once he's able to turn those critical thoughts around and say, this is not about her, this is about me. This is about my own insecurities with the individuality that is expressed in her life. Because when a person does not do a thing the way we do it, and we get critical, it's because of a loss of control, a lack of self-confidence. There's a sense that what they are doing threatens us because we don't understand it. We don't even particularly care about it. But it's causing a negative characteristic to rise up in me. And that's necessary for me to see. Because that's the complaining thing when I was talking about, right? The reason we complain is because we don't have any solving skills, right? So he's in a good place because he's at least seen that. Now what you want to pray for is ways to actually address it, to resolve it. Because believe it or not, what she does may work very well for the family. Don't get me wrong. When we see our spouses doing certain things, they can be wrong. You know, you sisters can be wrong once a year. You do know that, right? Once a year, you can be wrong. But the problem is that how do we go about resolving wrong patterns, wrong attitude, wrong motives in a way that does not destroy their humanness, destroy their confidence in themselves, destroy the bonding of the relationship. So you two have to be about honesty when it comes to how the other person is feeling. So why do you? Because like right now, here's what I know that happens. I need to stop. Because what we do is we get actually cycled into, we actually get addicted to conflict. And it actually becomes a characteristic of our conversation. And it becomes normative to us to be just at odds with each other. So what we're not doing is we're not thinking through the basis of that conflict, the validity of the charge that is coming in the conflict. Well, maybe I am doing something that could be done better. And then power trips are in play because he's my husband. He's telling me I need to change the way I do something. I don't need a man ruling over me. Whoa. See what I'm getting at? Or, and the husband saying she's stubborn and rebellious and incompliant and all of that other stuff. Well, it just means we have to work on our communication skills. And that also means we have to go back and learn. It's in those four pages. What it means to be a husband. What it means to be a wife. What it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman. And once we start going through the etymology of that, you can ask yourself, are you really a woman? Are you really a wife? Or are you something else? Because if I'm not operating according to the definition of what a wife and a woman is, no wonder I'm having trouble in a relationship with my man. Because I'm my own autonomous being perpetrating a lie. Because I said I'm a wife, but I'm not operating as a wife. See what I'm getting at? So we'll work that through down the line. All right, I'm not taking any more tonight. We're going to pray, ask for God's mercy, and send you guys home safely. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for my brothers and sisters. We need you, Spirit of God. We need you, God. We need you in our life. We need you in our families. We need your grace and your strength and your mercy and your patience. We need you to open our hearts large so that we can love our spouses to the nth degree, to the uttermost. And that they might love us back to the uttermost, that we might be able to talk about anything without it being a threat to our relationship, that we might be able to disagree for one purpose, to go to the throne of grace and cry out for each other. Lord, give my husband prosperity and strength and blessing. Lord, give my wife grace and humility and wisdom and power and virtue. Grant that both of us might be able to execute our calling as a husband and wife before you in a way that glorifies and honors you. Bring peace to our home, righteousness to our home, and joy to our home, full of the Spirit of the living God, so that we might be a representation of Christ in the church. We can't do it without you. We need you, Lord. Break our stony hearts, as our brother said. Open our eyes and open our minds that we might comprehend your truth. Help us to see evil afar off and avoid it, Lord. Help the things that we talked about tonight sink deep down into our soul. Don't allow our sinful nature to throw off what we are being taught by you.
We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you.